Jesus, the name that charms our fears, that bids our sorrows cease. 'Tis music in the sinner's ears, 'tis life and health and peace.
Luke chapter 19, verses 28 through 48. After Jesus had said this, he went on ahead, going up to Jerusalem. When he had come near Bethpage and Bethany at the place called the Mount of Olives, he sent two of the disciples, saying, "Go into the village ahead of you, and as you enter it, you'll find tied there a colt that has never been ridden. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks you, 'Why are you untying it?' just say this, 'The Lord needs it.' So those who were sent departed and found it, as it had been told to them, and as they were untying the colt, its owners asked them, 'Why are you untying the colt?' And they said, 'The Lord needs it.' And then they brought it to Jesus, and after throwing their cloaks on the colt, they set Jesus on it. As he rode along, people kept spreading their cloaks on the road. As he was now approaching the path down from the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of the disciples began to praise God joyfully with a loud voice for all the deeds of power that they had seen, saying, 'Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest heaven.' Some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to him, 'Teacher, order your disciples to stop.' And Jesus answered, 'I tell you, if these were silent, the stones would cry out, or the stones would shout out.' As Jesus came near and saw the city of Jerusalem, he wept over it, saying, 'If you, even you, had only recognized on this day the things that make for peace, but now they're hidden from your eyes. Indeed, the day will come upon you when your enemies will set up ramparts around you and surround you and hem you in on every side. They will crush you to the ground, you and your children within you, and they will not leave within you one stone upon another, because you did not recognize the time of your visitation from God.' And then Jesus entered the temple and began to drive out those who were selling things there. And Jesus said, 'It's written that my house shall be a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of robbers.' Every day he was teaching in the temple. The chief priests, the scribes, and the leaders of the people kept looking for a way to kill him, but they did not find anything they could do, for all the people were spellbound by what they heard.
Plenteous grace with thee is found, grace to cover all my sin. Let the healing streams abound, make and keep me pure within. Thou of life, the fountain art, freely let me take of thee. Spring thou up within my heart, rise to all to eternity.
Last week we examined the whole book and looked at the scope of Luke's gospel, the setting, the audience, the themes, and the Jesus that Luke presents for us. Luke's Jesus is one that takes on the religious authorities and those authorities that work in the temple, and Jesus in Luke's gospel speaks up on behalf of the poor. He's a bold voice for justice, for the outcast, for the ones who exist on the margins of society, the widows and the orphans. And all of those folks were with him, invited by him, included by him. And they are the folks, if you read through the Gospel of Luke, who are always at his table, having fellowship with him. And so when he comes into the temple and he speaks on their behalf, I would say they didn't see him as an upstart. I would say they likely thought of him as a hero. I have very few heroes in my life. I'm already too hot. I can't do this. I have very few heroes in my life. And it's not a title that I award casually or without great feeling. But I want to try and tell you about one of my heroes today. His name is Bishop... That's him. Melvin G. Talbert. That's his name. He's the bishop who ordained me. That's him in the middle. He did a nice thing because he let my dad say the words, who is also a bishop, and stepped aside for a few minutes. This is a very special moment. Bishop Talbert has great influence on my ministry and my understanding of what it means to be a pastor. He retired some years ago from active work, though, as a bishop in our area out here in California. Bishop Talbert was born in Clinton, Louisiana, and Bishop Talbert was one of seven children, and he was born to sharecropper parents. He moved from the South, where he was raised and educated, and he came out here to Los Angeles in the West, and that's where his ministry was. And out here is where he was ordained as an elder in the United Methodist Church. And from Los Angeles, he served the church and ultimately was elected to be a bishop in the whole Western area. That happened in 1980. Bishop Talbert was my bishop, our bishop, in the years 1988 to 2000. And then he retired and he moved back to the South and he lives now in Tennessee. Bishop Talbert is a hero to me because at personal and professional risk, even though he's retired, he has taken a stand on behalf of the LGBTQI community. But also, he has taken a stand for me. And that's easier said than done, people. In retirement recently, Bishop Talbert said some things and did some things that got great attention, are getting great attention. He's the first United Methodist bishop to openly celebrate a same-sex marriage. And he did this under the protest of the resident bishop. That means the bishop who's in charge of the area. He let her know he was going to do it. She asked him not to. It was not in a Methodist church that he did this. And just as a matter of record, the two men were already legally married. The ceremony took place at a United Church of Christ in Birmingham, Alabama. It celebrated the marriage of Joe Openshaw and Bobby Prince. And same-sex marriage is not legal in Alabama. So actually, the certificate that Bishop Talbert signed is not binding by state law, but it is significant to this couple who wanted a holy and sacred ceremony. They're United Methodist men. The couple was legally married in Washington on September 3rd of this year. Bishop Talbert understands tradition, but he feels strongly that the church cannot continue to fight against change. And he compares his work to the civil rights movement of times past. And Bishop Talbert doesn't make that comparison lightly, just so we all know, because he's been on the front lines of the civil rights movement his whole life. In October of 1960, while he was in Atlanta, he shared a jail cell with Dr. King. After he was arrested for kicking against the system of that day, back in the 60s, by he himself participating in those lunch counter sit-ins that we all have learned about in history. 40 years ago, Bishop Talbert had a completely different stance against homosexuality. And at the time, he felt strongly that Christianity and homosexuality did not mix. This all changed for him many years later when he attended a colloquium of straight and gay Methodists, and he taught us about this. He told us about how it happened for him, his moment of shift. So we went to this weekend retreat, and the people, all the people there involved, were not allowed in any way to share what their sexual preference was. At the conclusion of the gathering, they then revealed, and it completely changed everything for him. That's what he told us. A few years ago, he made this statement on racial inclusivity. He said this: God's table is large enough to include everybody. God does not exclude anyone. Each person is welcome to the table of God, and each person has the responsibility to claim that place. This is my editorial. This sounds like the Gospel of Luke to me. That's why I am so disturbed, he goes on, by how our church is dealing with the issue of GLBT people. These are our brothers and sisters in Christ, and yet somehow we have decided that we need to become God and therefore decide you can serve and you can't serve. If people come in and say, he said, that they believe in God and Jesus Christ, they are welcome and they have no right, we have no right to exclude anyone on the basis of their status in life, race, gender, or economic status. No matter what it is, we are all one. That's the end of that statement. Bishop Talbert was ordained as an elder in the United Methodist Church, just like me, just like Matt. This means, just like me, just like Matt, that he was given authority to preach the word, which is what I'm doing right now, to preside over the sacraments, that means baptize and serve communion, and order the life of the church. The office of the bishop, so that's a little different than just being an elder, exists in the United Methodist Church as a particular ministry. And bishops are elected from elders, like me, like Matt, who are ordained to be those ministers I just told you about. A bishop gets elected by his peers or her peers. And then a bishop is consecrated. And this is what that means. That our bishops are given a bit of additional authority. And their authority rests in oversight. And here's the words: to guard the faith, to seek the unity, and to exercise the discipline of the whole church, and to supervise and support the church's life, work, and mission throughout the whole world. So we saw fit to elect him and to consecrate him. And now, some are no longer happy with that decision. And they are asking, by what authority does Bishop Melvin Talbert say and do these things? Okay? I'm going to go back to the Gospel of Luke now. Luke's gospel testimony is that the leaders of that day miss the authority of Jesus. Sometimes studying the Bible can lead all of us to new discoveries that challenge our lives and turn our world upside down and cause us to rethink our lives. And this can be scary and frightening, but it can also free us, you know, to grow in our faith. And as I said last week, each of the Gospels presents the story of Jesus in a different and particular way. And much of their richness is lost if we ever try to harmonize all of them into one consistent account. Every Gospel contains a different structure, and it develops different themes, and it portrays Jesus in a unique way. And this morning I'm really talking about Luke's Jesus. Because that's what we're examining for 3 weeks. Now, Matt read for us the beginning of the section of Luke, which gives this summary account of the rhythm of Jesus' life when he got into Jerusalem. In case you missed it, here's the rhythm. During the day, he taught the people at the temple. And at night, he lodged on this mountain called Olivet. And his days began early, and meeting the people at the temple is what he did from early in the morning till evening, full on days. On many occasions when that was happening, Jesus is questioned. Not by the people he's teaching, not by the crowds who are gathered around him, but by the leaders, okay? So I want to read these two verses. Listen to what comes right after that. In Luke 20. It's up there. One day as he was teaching the people in the temple and telling the good news, the chief priests and the scribes came with the elders and said to him, "Tell us, by what authority are you doing these things? Who is it who gave you this authority?" The place and authority of a pastor or a religious teacher is actually a very fair question to hold. It's happening today, right now, with Bishop Talbert. That's what they're doing. And it happened to Jesus. There in the temple, Jesus is teaching the people, and the chief priests, scribes, and elders interrupt, and they raise objections, and they question his authority. Jesus, in turn, responds and silences them, at least for the time being. It's a fair question. One commentary writes about it like this. It's a central question in religion, more so than in the practice of law and in the practice of medicine. Because in religion, prophets and preachers claim authority, which is in some ways difficult to check out. We often applaud the appearance of a prophetic figure whose authority seems to be directly from God and not mediated through the usual academic and ecclesiastical channels. Such persons bring not only refreshment, but sometimes they bring reformation. And for this reason, the church has sought in its various traditions to join God's divine call with an examination and ordination by the faith community as a way not only of giving authority, but of protecting the flock and maintaining the continuity of the faith. Just as an aside, that's why Sarah's going to preach in this room, and you're going to get forms to fill out to see what you think of what she said and to help her to discern whether or not she's really called to be a pastor or not.
No pressure.
Oh, you're here. We got your back, Warfield. The question of authority is easy to read as challenging in this case. And I think if we're not careful, it's easy to lay blame, you know, on those leaders who were unable to recognize Jesus' authority. But really, really, it's what we do. We do it all the time. Listen, the Council of Nicaea had to decide, should the teachings of Arius be allowed? Then Innocent III had to decide on St. Francis's authority. Maybe he was nuts. He gave away all his money, for God's sake. Think about that. Leo IX had to decide on Martin Luther's authority. He nailed stuff to the door. Don't know about that. The Church of England had to decide on John Wesley's authority. We come from him. People who are burned and bored by church enter our doors and see a female pastor. And they have to decide, what am I going to do about that? And let me tell you, people wonder. God is a mystery. That's what Matt and I say over and over. And we say that God's future is unfolding. And we say with authority that that's a valid approach to one's understanding of God's incarnation. You have to decide. By what authority do we say those words? Theologians, you see, are supposed to know what's true and what is the best doctrine. And yet if we ever presume on our own knowledge, we risk missing quite possibly the very core of the gospel, which is good news to the people and never, hardly ever necessarily good news to those who hold the power, and often also very hidden from those who deem themselves very wise and intelligent. So Luke's gospel testimony is that the leaders miss the authority of Jesus and the people recognize the authority of Jesus, and that's enough for Luke, and he expects it to be enough for all of us too. Is it? You're going to have to decide. So just hold on to that. Those authorities, I want to just tell you about them briefly. We call them chief priests and scribes and elders. And I want you to know that they inherit their power. They supervise the temple activities, they read the law, they assign the duties, and they instruct the priests. And the elders' authority is social and economic. They are the heads of the leading families of Jerusalem, the Kennedys, the Rockefellers, the Kaisers. You get it? Their authority is solid. They take this seriously. They know their job is to guard the tradition. And within this understanding, it would be common for a rabbi to come in and teach in their temple. And last week what we learned is that Luke established the genealogy of Jesus, and that's where he's seen, in that line. So he's considered in a kind of a rabbi who's teaching. So he's there teaching like a rabbi would. And then he starts pointing out where the leaders in the temple are lacking. And before we jump too quickly to identify with Jesus in his conflict and trash the religious authorities of his day, let's be really clear that the leaders were really only doing their duty. Jesus entered the temple. Jesus announced that it was going to be destroyed. And for the security of the people and the temple, the religious authorities had a responsibility to investigate Jesus. So how do we resolve this? Well, we have to wonder about it first. Who is this Jesus that we say we follow? Because he is essentially walking into a church, I imagine coming down the center aisle and announcing, "Hey, hey, God ordained me. God anointed me to preach good news to the poor, proclaim release to the captives, recovering of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, and to proclaim the year of the Lord." He says it with authority. Bishop Talbert marches up to the microphone after our general conference voted on our stance on homosexuality, and he said, "We are not treating these people right. I'm not going to do it anymore, and if you want me to, I'm going to perform these marriages." He's clear. And by taking this stand, he leads those of us who are pastors in the field to do the same. He ordained me to preach the word and administer the sacraments and order the life of the church. And I'm clear about my call to officiate at weddings in our community of faith. It's the United Methodist Church as an institution that is not of one mind. And Bishop Talbert said this, quote, "I felt compelled as a bishop to declare that the derogatory language and restrictive laws in our book of discipline are wrong, immoral, and unjust, and no longer deserve our loyalty and support." You see, religious leaders carry this responsibility. And it's a double-edged responsibility that may at times lead us into conflict. Because those of us who are ordained represent both God and our denomination. And we're responsible both for maintaining the distinctive teachings and practices of our tradition and for correcting them when they fail to advance God's redemptive work. So what are we going to do when the teachings or the traditions of the church fail to conform to the pastor's convictions regarding God's purpose? How does one know where our responsibility lies? Because the failure of the religious leaders who confronted Jesus was actually not in raising the question of Jesus' authority, but in being more concerned about their own position and their own honor than about discerning what distinguished those who were doing God's redemptive work, see, among God's people. So Matt and I are really well aware of the conflicted ways and the division in the United Methodist Church. And we could choose to invest our lives in changing this policy from the top down. And frankly, honestly, I think Matt would make a damn good bishop. I do. But thankfully, we have Bishop Talbert right now. And therefore, it feels far more faithful because we talk about this. And much deeper, to simply live out all means all right here in this context, on this corner of God's creation. And in doing this, we are going to trust the process that God's unfolding grace is going to happen in our wider denomination, and that it will someday express that eclectic and diverse expression of humanity that, if you look around this room, is really beautiful. It's our life together. And at the same time, I say that, some among us sitting here in this room have asked us for clarification on our opinions. Like, what does the scripture say, and what does the United Methodist Church say about human sexuality, and specifically about homosexuality and marriage equality? And we just want you to know that we hear your questions and we hear your wondering, and it just takes time for us to plan things. And we plan to teach on this when the moment's right. And sometimes this can lead us into trouble. So by what authority today does someone such as Bishop Talbert take such a prophetic action? I want to say that after hours and hours of closed door sessions throughout last week, all of our bishops, active and retired, but only the active ones can vote, took a vote. And they respectfully requested a formal complaint be filed against Bishop Talbert. They requested it. It hasn't happened yet. The Council of Bishops of the United Methodist Church are struggling with the exact same kinds of questions that the religious authorities were in Jesus' day that Luke is sharing with us in this gospel. And they are saying, the Council of Bishops, by what authority does Bishop Talbert say and do these things? So what happens is that another bishop, Bishop Winner, who has to make the decision, and they interviewed her. And this is what she said about this, on determining what she was going to do and how she was going to respond to this voted request for a complaint. She said, "A council's request for a complaint requires prayerful consideration. I will engage in conversation with Bishop Wallace Paget." She was the bishop of the area he did this marriage in. "I will engage in conversation with Bishop Wallace Paget, and we will do this discernment in a timely manner. I do not think it appropriate to take immediate action because the question is too important for the church to hurry." It's true that determining when and how to respond to God's call does take prayerful consideration. It is also true, in some cases, that the time for going slow and taking our time is suspect. And especially when, it's suspect when, the slower you go, the longer the authorities in power get to stay in power and get to call the shots and get to feel comfortable and feel strong. That academics which urge gay and lesbian couples to go slow on same-sex marriage ought to surprise nobody. As chronicled in this book by Carol Palsgrove, she wrote a book called Divided Minds, Intellectuals and the Civil Rights Movement. White intellectuals, she says, with very rare exceptions, advised African Americans to be patient, even after the Brown decision, even after the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 65 Voting Rights Act, rather than risk the anger and violence of white Southerners. That's our history. Dr. King also wrote from Birmingham, Alabama. That's where that wedding took place, just saying, Birmingham, Alabama, of what Dr. King called the myth of time. He said, "I guess it's easy for those who have never felt the stinging darts of segregation to say, wait." He wrote that the myth of time grew out of a tragic misconception of time. And it is the strangely irrational notion that there is something in the very flow of time that will inevitably cure all this. "And actually, time is neutral," he said. "It can be used either destructively or constructively. And I'm coming to feel that the people of ill will have used time much more effectively than the people of goodwill," he wrote from jail. "And we will have to come to repent in this generation, not merely for the vitriolic words and actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence of the good people." The Jesus of Luke's gospel is not one to tell us to go slow. This Jesus arrives in Jerusalem. He takes stock of the teaching in the temple and throws everybody out. Then he weeps over what he sees as the failure of the church to recognize and minister to the people, all the while it builds up its own coffers and power. And Jesus teaches through parable and story that the way to follow him is to reach in love to the poor, the oppressed, the outcast, and the marginalized, period. And the people get it, and the leaders don't. And this is easy to see in retrospect. But today, we are in the thick of it. And some parts are really clear. I know what I have to do. But what we don't know is where the church will actually land. Or at least we don't know when it will actually land. I have faith that it will. The temple in Jerusalem was in ruins. Ruins. And in just a few more chapters, Jesus dies. So maybe hearing this day a little bit about Bishop Talbert and knowing the conflicted place in which we weigh our own interests against God's call that all really does mean all, might shine a light on how challenging it really is for all of us to follow Jesus. We call it rooting our lives in grace. We call it growing in faith and then reaching out of that in love. And we do it by trying to do good, do no harm, and practicing the Christian disciplines. Easier said than done.
Lover of my soul, let me to